Hello, and welcome to the Mana Jog Pod, which is the second geography podcast by me, Mark Howe, which is a revision podcast for the OCRB Geography GCSE exam. And particularly, this revision podcast is for the decision making exercise exam, which this year is on the 20th of January 2011. I'd like to start by thanking everyone who downloaded this podcast in June of this year for the OCRC exam. I originally only recorded this with the intention of it being distributed to my students, and in the end it got downloaded well over 1,000 times and received some very positive reviews. So thank you very much to anyone who downloaded it. Hopefully that isn't too many people, because hopefully anyone who downloaded the one in June passed their exam and has no need to resit this year. It's a different specification anyway that I'll be working on this year. The OCRC specification no longer exists, and so I've personally switched to the OCRB exam, and so I'll be preparing you for that exam. The format of this podcast is that I'll go through the notes in the pre-release. You ho should hopefully be aware that the OCRB DME exam comes with a booklet of pre-release notes, and it's going to be handy if you've got that in front of you to listen to this. While you listen to this, in order that we can go through the resources together. I'll give you some additional notes about each of the resources and give you some pointers as to what to expect in terms of questions for each of the various resources. This podcast has been prepared so that really it's a way of you doing some extra revision in the lead up to the exam, perhaps on a bus or as you walk to school or whatever you need to do. And hopefully it'll encourage some people who perhaps wouldn't otherwise do an awful lot of revision for the exam to do it, to at least do something. So hopefully you find this helpful. So I'll start with one. It seems to be a decent place to start us off, which is all about the increase in tourism which has occurred in the last sort of 50 or 60 years or so. And it gives us three pieces of information. First of all, it gives us a graph which plots the number of international tourists in millions, and how that's changed between 1950 and 2010. And for most students, this should be very, very straightforward to interpret. I mean, it tells us that in 1950, around about 25, 30 million people went on holiday internationally, and that's grown steadily over 60 years until we get in 2010 to somewhere around about 950, getting on for 1 billion tourists in 2010. Very easy to interpret. Obviously, if you're asked a question about this, it's probably worth saying not only is it increased, but offering some numbers. They were then given a spider diagram, which shows us some of the reasons why this increase has occurred. And we're given eight reasons, and I'd like to come back to those in more detail in a moment. And we're then given some general information about why tourism has become important to the global economy. It tells us that it's an employer of 204 million people, which is 10.6% of the global workforce. It tells us it's the leading economic contributor, 10.2% of the world's GNP, which is the total earnings globally. And also tells us that it accounts for 10.9% of consumer spending, so around 10%, 10.9% to be exact, of all money spent is on tourism. Around 10.7% of all capital invested in improvement and money invested by business is done so in the name of tourism and by tourist companies. And it also accounts for 6.9% of government spending, and I suppose that would go in promotion and in supporting the tourist industry in their own country. Now, I think the focus of this first resource needs to be on the spider diagram and the reasons why tourism has grown. In past DMEs, there were more marks. You might be aware that on the old exam, on the old OCRC, you had a 60-mark paper which you had an hour and 45 minutes to complete. It's now a 40-mark paper which you have an hour to complete. And if we use last June's OCRB DME as a model, what I think they're likely to do is remove some of the very short, maybe 2, 3, 4 mark questions and go for more in the way of sort of 6, 7, 8 mark questions. I therefore think it's unlikely that in resource one you're going to be asked a simple question which asks you to interpret the graph. That may have been the case in previous DMEs, but I think now if you're going to get a question on resource one, it's going to be perhaps a lot more difficult. So if we look at the teacher's notes for resource one, it says that the resource one gives information on the growth of international tourism, the reasons for this growth, and the input of tourism into the global economy, and that students should be aware of the interactions between these various things. So what I think the best thing to do in resource one is to look at each of the reasons why tourism has increased and explain for you how each of those things has led to an increase in tourism. I suspect that a question on Resource One would ask you to do that. It might say, look at two of the reasons why tourism increased, explain why they have led to an increase in tourism. Or it might give you two specifically that it wants you to explain. So starting with paid leave, on Spiderhang, it tells us that people now have more paid leave from work. What this means is that in the past, people would have worked maybe 6, 7 days a week, and they would not have had any sort of designated holiday time. It's common now, most jobs will allow people to have a standard amount is 4 weeks paid holiday per year, and this is time they can take off while still getting paid from work. Now, obviously, this is only something that's come about in the last 50 years, and so therefore, it's something that allows people to travel more. Not only do they have extra time that they can go traveling in, but also extra cash. They're still being paid whilst they're having that holiday. So it's a case of more time and more money has allowed people to do more in the way of traveling. It also tells us that the wage levels have now gone up, which means people have more disposable income. Disposable income is a term you need to be aware of, and it's the sort of term you ought to be using in a geography GCSE exam. Disposable income is the money you've got left over once you've paid for the essentials. Once you've paid for a roof over your head and for food and for all your essential living costs, it's the money you've got left over to spend on whatever you want. And this tells us over the last 60 years, wage levels have gone up, and therefore people have more disposable income. They therefore have more income to spend on luxuries, and holidays and tourism is a luxury. So people have more disposable income, they can spend more on holidays. Life expectancy has gone up, and this may not be immediately obvious to all people as to why this would lead to an increase in tourism. However, retired people in this country, the over 65s, tend to have more time on their hands, and so therefore there's more time when they are able to go travelling. Retired people also tend to have a fair amount of wealth. They tend to have built up some money over their lifetime, which some people choose to spend once they're in their retirement. So the fact that life expectancy has increased means there is more people who are now over the retirement age, and therefore more people wishing to go on holiday. Expectations is the next reason why tourism increases, because people now expect to go on holiday each year. Having spoken to older generations in my family, it was not an expectation 40 or 50 years ago that people go on holiday. My mother, will tell me stories about the fact she went to Spain when she was very young and was the first person in her class to go abroad. There is now an expectation most students will have been abroad with family, and once they grow up and get jobs of their own and families of their own, they will expect to take their children on holiday. And this certainly wasn't the case 50 or 60 years ago. So obviously it's led to an increase in tourism. People expect to have a holiday. Advertising is the next reason why tourism increased. And it says more advertising for holidays on TV and the internet. First thing to point out is the internet certainly, and TV to a certain extent, has only come about in the last 50 or 60 years. These are massive channels of information and media where travel agents and tour companies can show us the sort of holidays they're offering. These channels of information were not available 50 years ago, and so people are now more aware of offers and more aware of promotions and more aware of places they can go and visit. And that ties in with global awareness, which is the next point why tourism increased. It says people are now more aware of the world and want to see more of it. Part of that, again, is down to the internet and television. People see travel shows on TV and more aware of other cultures, more aware of other places, and they want to go see those places. Again, that wouldn't have existed 50, 60 years ago. People perhaps weren't aware of what America was like, what even perhaps Europe was like. And so now people are, they want to go and see it for themselves. The next point why tourism has increased is decreasing cost of tourism. Budget airlines have meant that people can travel for less. 50, 60 years ago, travel internationally was very expensive and can only be afforded by probably the very wealthy. Nowadays, budget airlines like Ryanair, EasyJet mean you can get flights to Europe for under £1 sometimes. And certainly, relative to our wages, the cost of travel has greatly decreased. Part of that is about economies of scale. You might be aware of that term from business studies, those who learn business studies, that once a business starts to produce more of something, its costs become lower. Think of a supermarket like Tesco's. They're able to produce things incredibly cheaply because they make so much of them. It's the same with airlines. Because airlines run so many flights these days, they're able to offer them for very, very low cost. It doesn't cost them an awful lot to run a flight because they do so many, therefore they're able to offer their customers very cheap prices. And so because costs have decreased, because wage levels have gone up, more people are able to afford holidays and they've become relatively cheaper. Finally, tourism has increased because of a quest for adventure. People now want to do more exciting things. In the past, people were happy with their sort of, well, not necessarily happy, but people were accepting of their lives in Britain or wherever they were based, and didn't particularly see a need to get about. Now people want excitement. They want to do something different. They want to try other things. They want to experience the world. And so there is a greater desire for people to get away. As I said already, if you're going to get a question on this resource, it's almost certainly going to be about that spider diagram. It's almost certainly going to get you to interpret one, two, maybe three of those reasons why tourism has increased and explain possibly why they've happened, or possibly explain why though each of these has led to an increase in tourism. So in terms of a question here, I think if you're going to be asked a question this time around on Resource One, it's not going to be a simple data interpretation. It's not going to be a say what you see question, which you used to get in the past. It's going to be interpreting this spider diagram. It's going to be saying, possibly getting you to say why two of these factors has occurred, or why two of these factors has led to an increase in tourism. And it's going to be an explain question rather than a describe type question. Okay, it's going to want you to say why something's happened. You're going to need to use words like because and therefore. So you're going to need to say things like paid leave has increased because people over the last few years have put more value on their social time, and employers have recognized that people want time off, and therefore this means people have more time to travel. Okay, so that's me explaining that point. I've told you why it's happening, and I've told you why it has led to an increase in tourism. And that's the kind of thing you're going to need to do to get the marks there. You're going to need to do more than what it just says on the spider diagram. So resource two is a collection of photographs which are tourist attractions of the Caribbean. And in the teacher's guide to this, we're told that candidates need to understand that there are both human and physical attractions. Okay, so you should be aware, hopefully from your geography studies, of the difference between human features and physical features. Human features are man-made, physical features are natural things. And you need to be aware that in the Caribbean, there are both human and physical attractions there. First of all, taking a step back, it's worth pointing out the Caribbean is a collection of islands off the coast of Mexico, just south of Florida, which is obviously the most southern US state. And it's in the tropical belt. They get very, very hot weather there throughout a fair amount of the year. They get hurricane season for around about 3 months. And tourism there has become very, very popular, particularly with Americans, but also Europeans over the last 50 years. It's become a very, very popular holiday destination. And in Resource 2, we're given some of the things that people go there to see. So starting the top left-hand corner, we're given there's some quite attractive buildings there, which is obviously supposed to demonstrate some of the architecture there, which is very, very appealing to some people. And that's obviously a human factor. In the top middle, we're given some lovely scenery there. You can see some mountains, what looks like a jungle, city down below. And so obviously this is the jungle and the mountains is supposed to say there's some great physical features of the landscape there you might want to go and see. We've got the city down below, which obviously human, and you may wish to visit some of the cities. The top right hand corner is a turtle. Wildlife in the Caribbean is very well known. You've got all sorts of coral reefs and tropical creatures living there, which you may want to go and see. Obviously that's a physical feature. The middle right, we've got a guy playing steel pans. I think this is supposed to demonstrate the culture of the Caribbean. It's quite a bohemian kind of lifestyle there. People are thought to be very relaxed, very chilled kind of lifestyle. Reggae music is very important part of the culture there. And so obviously that's a human feature which someone would want to go to the Caribbean for. They'd want to experience that lifestyle. Bottom right-hand corner is perhaps two things. We're shown a sandy beach, which obviously says people might want to go and see the physical features of the beaches and the wonderful clear water there. But at the same time, we've got a boat there. It looks like a catamaran. And so this is suggesting perhaps that there's a human feature. We might want to go and take part in water sports there. And certainly that's something you can do. In the bottom middle, again, we've got two things. We've got the jungle, which is obviously a physical feature, something you might want to go and see. But also we've got what looks like sort of Inca pyramids. And so there's a tremendous amount of history in the Caribbean, which people might want to go and see. And obviously this is a human attraction. Bottom left hand corner again is a sandy beach and palm trees, and as we said a moment ago, that's a physical feature which someone might want to go and see. And in the middle left, we've got a couple getting married on a beach. This is something that's become more popular in the last few years, people wishing to get married in less traditional ways, you know, less people wanting to get married in churches and that sort of thing, and more people choosing to do something a little bit different. And certainly getting married on beaches in the Caribbean has become more popular in recent years. And obviously this is kind of a combination of human and physical here. It's the human concept of marriage, but it's the physical attraction of wanting to do it on a beach that attracts people to the Caribbean. Now, I think personally that it's unlikely you're going to get a question just on resource two on its own. I think that, you know, a question such as list two human factors of the Caribbean would be very, very basic on a GCSE exam paper, and I wouldn't expect to see something like that. Hopefully, if something like that came, you'd be in a position to do that. What I think is more likely is they will link resource two with either resource one or three to offer a greater level of difficulty. So if we link quickly back to resource one, you might get a question which says, looking at the tourist attractions in resource two and the reasons why tourism has increased in resource one, why do you suppose tourism has increased in the Caribbean in the past 50 years? And so you need to look at the sort of things that go on in the Caribbean and the sort of things that have led to an increase in tourism and try and cross-reference the two. So perhaps you'd say that people's quest for adventure has increased over the last 50 years. And from looking at the Caribbean, we can see that it offers water sports and you can go and look at sort of wild animals and that sort of thing. And so the Caribbean may offer adventure that people don't get at home. Therefore, combining those two ideas, tourism in the Caribbean has increased. We might also say something about global awareness. People are now more aware of places like the Caribbean and they therefore would like to travel there, whereas in the past they may not have been aware of some of these wonderful attractions that are there. I also think that resource two links to resource three, and you're very, very likely to get a question which references those two or puts those two resources together. So I'm now going to go on to talk about resource three. Now, tourism can have a varying impact on the environment of a place, and it can do little damage to an environment. It can do lots of damage to an environment. In some cases, it can even protect the environment. And resource three breaks down where those differences are for us. It breaks into four categories. It basically says that how many people visit a place will determine how much damage is done to the environment. What sort of environment it is will determine how much damage there is, how long tourists have been going there, and how much a place changes with regards to tourism. Now, in the teacher's notes, you're asked to understand each of these impacts, really. So what I'll do is I'll go through each of them. So first of all, we'll look at the numbers of people. Obviously, tourism can mean sudden great numbers of people arriving in a place, and that can have a great impact on somewhere, usually a negative damage. Obviously, if more people are visiting a tourist resort, then more hotels need to be built, and often that sort of thing is going to be done on land where that perhaps was wildlife previously or perhaps was fragile ecosystems, and obviously that's going to cause problems. There's also going to be problems with congestion and traffic. You know, if you get more people visiting a place, there's going to be more cars about, more pollution, and more damage to the atmosphere around there. You're also going to get visual pollution, and if we look at the top two pictures on that page for resource three, we've got the visual pollution of a sort of a seaside resort. In the top left, we can see all these high-rise buildings being built. Doesn't look as good as it used to. And in the top right, we've got obviously a very overcrowded beach. And again, that's you know, not great. Now, I think you also need to be aware, at the top it says tourism may damage the environment, but it may help to protect it. And if you think slightly outside the box, tourism can actually help a place if lots of people go there. A classic example would be some of the nature reserves that have been set up in Africa, where tourist money has been used to fund game reserves where, you know, poachers and hunters are banned and animals can be preserved. Now, without the money that's gone into African tourism, these parts of Africa perhaps wouldn't be able to afford to do that. And so in some cases, it may be possible that high numbers of tourists can protect the environment. And that's something you need to be aware of for the exam. The second point that will impact or will determine how much of an impact tourism has is what type of environment we're dealing with. And the quote in the resource is how ecosystems can cope and recover from tourism. Some ecosystems are very able to cope with mass high numbers of people and high numbers of tourists, and others are not. What it comes down to is really how fragile the ecosystem is and how long it's taken to establish. So if we look at things like jungle environments, rainforest environments, we know these to be quite fragile. We know that these take many sort of hundreds of years to establish themselves. And so if we could go in and cut down a rainforest and build, you know, tourist facilities there, how long is it going to take the rainforest to cover? Well, several hundred years. It's not very able to do so. Coral reefs are another example. If people go and we offer tourism to go and visit coral reefs, and people damage those reefs by, you know, picking them apart when they're scuba diving or by boats or whatever it is that damages them. Coral reefs, again, take many hundreds of years to establish themselves, and that's not an ecosystem that will recover quickly. In contrast, other ecosystems can recover more quickly. Deserts being a prime example. If we go in and build a load of tourist facilities on the desert can recover fairly easily. It's not a fragile ecosystem. So time is another issue that determines how much damage is done to the environment. And the quote in the resource is how long tourist development has been happening. I guess the idea here is that if tourist development has been going on in a place slowly and over a long period of time, it's unlikely to have a massive effect on the environment. We can cope with it. You know, this is a place that's had tourism before, and slowly we're increasing the amount of tourism going on there. What's more likely to do damage is a place that previously perhaps didn't have any tourism, and suddenly thousands of people every year or hundreds of thousands of people every year are descending onto a place, and suddenly we need to build lots and lots of hotels, lots and lots of facilities. This is one of the concerns. I mean, if we look down at the bottom there to the left, we've got a picture of the Antarctic. At the minute, tourism in Antarctica is fairly limited. It's one or two sort of relatively brave people looking for an adventure type holiday or to go and see the penguins or whatever. If suddenly Antarctica becomes very popular for whatever reason and many thousands of people start to descend on Antarctica, we may have to very quickly respond to that by building hotels and these sort of facilities, and it may very quickly damage an environment which at the minute is okay. If, however, tourism in Antarctica slowly increases over the next couple of hundred years even, then the environment is more likely to be able to cope with that. It's going to be, you know, we're going to be chipping away at it rather than a big sudden scar on the landscape. The other final factor that influences the amount of damage done to the environment is change. It says how tourist development changes a place. In some cases, many tourists visiting a place may not actually change it a great deal. It may be that the uniqueness of the place and the sort of culture of the place and the lifestyle of the people who lived there before tourism is not damaged in any way. In other places, change can influence a place quite a lot. And again, if we look at the photograph above the change box, it's of sort of one of these Costa del Sol resorts where, 40 or 50, 60 years ago, they were very Spanish coastal fishing villages, very picturesque. Now, the place has been changed dramatically. High-rise hotel blocks. Visually, it's not the same, but culturally, it's very, very different. You know, you've got high numbers of tourists there. Not many local people actually live there year round. There's no business in the winter. You've got perhaps trouble with this Brits abroad culture and British people going there and not treating the place very nicely. So places like Benidorm and other places on the Costa del Sol have changed considerably because of tourism, and that can cause a lot of environmental damage in the ways we mentioned earlier: the building of hotel facilities, the pollution from traffic, litter, all those kind of things. Now, in terms of questions here, I think it's highly likely you're going to get a question which relates resource 2 and 3 together. I think that's an obvious link. And I think that one of the most obvious things might be that it might say offer you a question something along the lines of how might high numbers of tourists affect the Caribbean potentially? And so you'd be asked to think about the things that I've just mentioned. You'd be asked to look at those pictures of resource two and say, well, clearly we've got things like coral reefs. We've got a bit of what looks like a rainforest environment. These are environments that are likely to get damaged by tourists. We're going to have to build hotels there. People are going to go and see these places. They're going to damage them with their, you know, walking around, treading on things, dropping litter, boats being polluting the coral reefs. Turtles, perhaps their mating areas are going to become beaches that people sunbathe on, and therefore the turtles can't get there. You know, all those kind of things you're going to mention. You might also mention the positives. You know, it might be that because more people are visiting the Caribbean, the welfare of turtles is more, people are more aware of it globally, and so there's more money there and more interest there to protect turtles or protect the rainforest, or there's more of an awareness of, you know, Caribbean culture, and people do a lot more to sustain it, and there's more money within it. So if you get a question of this nature, what is tourism likely to do to the Caribbean, you know, be trying to look at both sides. Okay, do mention the damage to the environment, but I think for top marks you're going to need to look at how tourism money, what it can do to help some of the things you can see in resource two. Now, resource four is an interesting one. On the face of it seems quite sparse, and there's not a lot to it, and it is actually fairly straightforward, but I think it's potentially the most important resource in the entire booklet. It's two things. It's the problems of tourism and the ways to minimize the effects. So at the top we've got five problems associated with mass tourism. And very, very straightforward, it tells us that we've got increased sewage and urban runoff. Very quickly, urban runoff is the idea that in nature, in river basins and drainage basins, when it rains, water will seep into the ground and slowly find its way down into the river system. However, in an urban environment, that process is sped up. When it rains in an urban environment, it's concrete and you've got tarmac, things that water will not soak through. And so water is very quickly channeled into drains and finds its way into the river system much more quickly. What that means is that you're more likely to get floods, because the water, when it rains, the water is getting into the river much more quickly. So there's the problem there. Increased urbanisation is the next problem. And urbanisation, I hope you'll be aware, is the movement of people from rural areas to the city. So if that happens really quickly, that's going to be difficult for cities to cope with and difficult for cities to build homes quick enough, and you're going to possibly get slums and that kind of thing as more people come. Increased traffic, obviously a problem of convenience for people not getting around, but also a pollution problem. Destruction of habitats, we've already discussed this, you're going to get problems with animals losing their habitats. And water shortages, particularly tourists want things like hotel swimming pools in their hotels. They want to have access to clean running water. If you're dealing with an LEDC or a hot country where water is a bit scarce and you're then filling up swimming pools, you potentially got a problem there. Local people may not be able to access water for drinking. Well, not far down the road, you've got a five-star hotel with several swimming pools. So it can create water shortages. At the bottom of the page, we've got some information on responsible tourism. So if we want to do tourism in a way that doesn't do the things at the top, what have we got to look to do? And it puts it into three categories. We've got to it's got to be environmentally responsible, so it minimises negative impacts and can make positive contributions to the conservation of biodiversity, wilderness, natural and human heritage. It's also got to be socially responsible, and so it respects the local culture and traditions and leads to a greater understanding between tourists and local people. And finally, it's got to be economically responsible. So it's got to have financial benefits for local people and is based on fair trade. Now, I think that diagram at the bottom there is there to help you with your essay, which we're going to come to later on. This is a sustainable decision-making exercise. And so at the end of it, you'll be aware you have to do an essay writing task where you will have to come up with a sustainable tourism proposal for St. Lucia. Now, in order for something to be sustainable and to be responsible, it needs to do these things at the bottom of this resource. So whatever suggestion you come up with for your essay question must be environmentally responsible, socially responsible and economically responsible. And that model at the bottom there shows you what something must be in order to do that. Very little environmental damage, and even helps conserve local wildlife. Doesn't damage local culture, people won't be upset, and doesn't damage the local economy. People aren't going to lose out financially because of this. So I'm going to revisit the the model for responsible tourism a little bit later on when we come back to the essay question. I think if there's going to be a question on resource four, it's likely to be about the problems of mass tourism, and it's possibly going to relate back to previous resources, perhaps resource three, perhaps resource two. I think a very likely question here is similar to one that came up last year on the OCRB question, and that would be something like suggest why mass tourism may be unpopular with people living in the Caribbean. I think you'd be looking at somewhere in the region of 7 marks there, so quite a lot of marks for a question like that. So what would you have to do? Well, you need to look at some of those problems in resource 4 and again look back at resource 2 and look back at resource 3 and think about which of those things are most likely to occur in the Caribbean and what might upset local people. Now, clearly with a question of this type, you're going to be thinking about how do I pick up 7 marks? The first thing to say is that you won't get 7 marks just by lifting the information from the resource. If you just say tourism in the Caribbean will be unpopular with locals because of water shortages, destruction of habitats, increased traffic and increased urbanisation, you're going to limit yourself really to a maximum of 3 marks out of 7 at the absolute most. If you want to go beyond that, and I expect most people do because 3 out of 7 is probably, you know, at best a D grade and more likely an E or a U, you need to explain some of these points. So you need to take maybe a couple of them in detail and talk about why they are happening. Okay, so maybe let's say tourism in the Caribbean will be unpopular with locals because of water shortages. You would then go on to explain why there are water shortages. So you might say, well, if we're going to promote tourism in the Caribbean, tourists are going to come there, they're going to want swimming pools in their hotels, and they're going to want clean running water. The Caribbean is quite a hot place, and it may be that clean water is quite scarce. And if we're then going to use lots of it on the tourists, local people may find it difficult to get water. That you're then beginning to explain, and you're then beginning to get yourself more than 3 marks. If you really want to go to the top and get sort of top marks out for this, you'd need to explain why it would be unpopular. So you'd need to make the point that local people are then going to become very unhappy with water shortages. They may have to pay more for their water, and there's going to be a resentment of the tourists. So in order to get your top marks, you've got to explain these points. You've got to do more than what it just says in the resource, and you've got to offer some opinion on why you think people would not like this idea. Now, resources 1 to 4 are very much sort of background information, and there will be questions about resource 1 to 4, but they're likely to be worth fewer marks than some of the questions later on. You're talking about 4, 5, 6, maybe a maximum of 7 marks for some of those resources. With resource 5 and 6, it changes tone slightly, and we're given a sort of case study about a place called Benidorm, which is on the Costa Blanca in Spain. Now, it starts off with we're given 4 pictures of Benidorm. We're given a picture on the two pictures on the left of 1936 and 2010. And in 1936, it's described as a sleepy fishing village with 2 beautiful beaches, whereas in 2010, it's described as the Manhattan of Spain with hotels, bars and discos as far as the eye can see. On the right-hand side, we're given the picture of a hotel in 1930 and the same hotel in 2010. And obviously, the idea there is that both the hotels changed quite a lot, but also the busyness of the beach and the surroundings of the hotel. In 1930, it appears that Hotel Marconi is sort of on its own, whereas in 2010 it's turned itself into a high-rise hotel with several others around it. We're then given a whole load of background information about Benidorm, and I'll very quickly read through it. It says, in 1930, Benidorm was a sleepy fishing village with 3,113 residents, 2 great beaches, and just a few hotels. The first package tourists arrived in 1957. Tourists loved the sun, peace and quiet. Soon many hotels and apartments were being built, often with grants from the Spanish government. But there was little planning or control, and buildings were often of poor quality. In April 1967, the airport at Alicante was first opened. As air travel expanded and became more affordable, more tourists flocked to the Spanish coast, attracted by great weather and great package deals. Many other early holiday resorts were based on the successful model of Benidorm, whose success was at a peak in the 1970s. 1977 was the very highest ever, with a whopping 12 million visitors to Benidorm. By the late 1980s, Benidorm had a poor image. It was crowded with bars and discos everywhere. Many of the hotels were cheap and shoddy and not what the brochures promised. It attracted lagerlouts and tourist numbers began to decline. But Benidorm is really important to Spain. It contributes over 5% of its gross domestic product, or GDP. So all the wealth in Spain, 5% of it is contributed by this place. The Spanish government became concerned about Benidorm's reputation and have now taken more control of its development. Poor quality hotels have been improved, new high quality ones have been built, and four major theme parks have been set up nearby to attract visitors all year round. Today, the town is Spain and Europe's biggest holiday resort. Its reputation is improving, with the government sponsoring an expensive advertising campaign. 5 million tourists a year arrive to holiday in the resort, and the huge range of accommodation and facilities attracts visitors young and old, families and singles. Most arrive in the summer, though the mild temperatures in winter make Benidorm popular all year round, with northern Europeans arriving for a bit of winter sun. So a pretty comprehensive account there of this place, Benidorm, and the changes it's gone through since the 1930s. On the right-hand side, on resource 6, we're given a model of change in a tourist area over time. Now, this model hasn't been specifically created to Benidorm, but it applies very, very easily to it. And it's obviously a boom and bust graph, which goes through five different stages. Basically, in each stage, different things are occurring as tourism changes a place. And as we pass through each stage, we go through time. Now, interestingly, at the bottom, it's just as time. It doesn't give us specific years. That's because different tourist resorts will pass through this model at different speeds and at different times. So it's impossible to apply specific dates to this. So in stage one of the tourist model, a place is where a small number of tourists are attracted by the natural beauty and few facilities exist. And if we look at the graph at the top, we can see that tourism is very, very few people are going there, and it only begins to grow right at the end of stage one. So it's a quite a rural place, quite a remote environment perhaps, that's got some natural beauty that attracts people to it. Stage two is what we call growth, and this is where local people become involved in tourists and recognisable tourist season and facilities develop. So what happens is we've got a remote place with some natural beauty, one or two people start to visit. When we reach stage two is when local people begin to take an interest in this. They begin to realise it's a money-making opportunity. They begin to build facilities, and there's perhaps a season where people will go there. And through stage two, tourism will grow. Okay, more and more people will visit. It reaches stage three, which is a boom or a maturity stage, when large numbers of tourists arrive. Large-scale global companies become involved, so Hilton and your big hotel companies will become involved, your big airlines will start doing flights there. It says tourism becomes a large part of the economy of the area, so people become dependent on it. We've got lots of local people working in hotels, in ice cream parlors, in restaurants, in bars, in cafes. Okay, and so it employs a significant number of local people. And it says many facilities have now developed, so hotels, swimming pools, whatever. And that's the boom of a place, and that's when it's at its best, making its most money, and local people are doing well. It's a good tourist resort with lots of facilities. However, places then start to go into decline. So as peak numbers of tourists have passed, resorts no longer thought a good place to visit. It can become dependent on day or weekend visitors, and the facilities old and run down. So once we get into this bust stage, tourist numbers start to decline because the hotels are looking a bit old and run down. The place is no longer as attractive as it used to be. Local people have become dependent on the tourists. So when the tourists aren't there, they're struggling for cash. And the place just loses its popularity. It's no longer a novelty. It's no longer that interesting to people. Finally, we go into stage five, which is redevelopment. So the attractiveness continues to decline, so fewer and fewer visitors. And long-term decline will take place unless steps are taken to redevelop the area. Rebranding and re-imaging are often needed. So this decline will continue. If a place just accepts it and says, right, tourism here, we're losing tourists, we're just going to accept that, it will continue to decline, and the place will become poorer and poorer, and the facilities will become more and more out of date, and less people will go there. What you can do is take steps to change that, and you can decide to rebrand a place, redevelop a place, build new hotels, perhaps update the existing ones, perhaps offer something new and exciting to do there, perhaps offer special deals on people traveling there. And if you do that and you do that well, you can start this cycle all over again. So whilst this is a graph that goes from left to right, what it can actually do is go round in a circle. So if stage five, a place does well with its rebranding and redevelopment, you can go all the way back to stage one and start the model all over again. Now, these two resources have been put side by side for a very good reason. The example of Benidorm, or the case study of Benidorm, is can be linked very closely to this model. And even you can break down the paragraphs to see what happens. So Stage one, when was Benidorm in stage one? Well, we can see it's sort of pre-1930. If we look at the photos of Benidorm in 1930, and then we look at the description, 3,113 beach residents and a couple of beaches and a few hotels. That was when Benidorm was in stage one. Very few people went there, only a few tourist facilities, and the natural beauty, as we can see in the photos, was still there. Throughout the 1950s, late 1950s and 1960s, tourism in Benidorm was in its growth stage. More people were going there, and more hotels and other facilities began to open. It tells us that 1977 was the highest ever year. So early 70s, or so perhaps sort of mid-70s, Benidorm reached stage three. It reached its maturity stage. And the peak of the graph for Benidorm was in 1977. That's when the most number of people went there. From 1977, it's begun to decline. And throughout the 1980s, fewer and fewer people were going there. So from sort of 1980 onwards, it went into stage four. It went into decline. Very, very recently, in the last few years, Benidorm has perhaps gone into stage five of redevelopment. The government's realised it's the concern there, realised that they need this place to make them money for their GDP, and are starting to invest money, and it's becoming more popular again. So Benidorm has gone back to stage one and is now back into stage two, where tourist numbers are on the increase and more people are going there. Now, I think it's unlikely that you're going to be asked a question which gets you to do that in the exam, but hopefully that's a simple task if it does. You could be asked a very simple question, which could be, in what years did Benidorm go through each of the stages? I think that's very unlikely, but you need to be able to do that and need to be able to relate Benidorm to the model. So what is a more likely question? Well, so what are you going to be asked here? Well, it's very likely, in fact, it's almost 100% certain that you're going to be asked a question which uses both resource and five together. What you've got here is a case study, an example of tourism, how it's changed a place. What I think you're very likely to get asked is a 7-mark question. If we look at the last few years, case study questions it's going to be for about 7 marks. And it's going to be something along the lines of, why did the Spanish government decide to invest in Benidorm and decide to spend this money, all this money, redeveloping Benidorm? Now, what you obviously need to do is explain, first of all, very simply, that they're looking to go through the model of tourism again. They're looking to reset the clock, if you like, back to stage one and go through this growth and maturity again in order to make money. Now, that's a very basic answer. What you need to do for a more complex answer is again, explain why that's going to happen. So you need to explain that by revamping the place, rebranding it, promoting it again, advertising it again, building these theme parks, updating the hotels, you're hoping that more people, more local people will become involved with tourists, and more people will begin to visit again. You're hoping for another boom. You're hoping for more global companies to get involved. You know, you're hoping for companies like Hilton to come along and set up a new hotel there. You're hoping for somebody to pay for the airport to get revamped. And you're hoping that travel agents will spend more money and again make this place popular. So why would you want to do that as a Spanish government? Well, you're obviously going to make taxes. You're going to make money from this place doing well and from foreign people coming in and spending their money there. That's going to make you a richer government. So the Spanish government are very keen for that to happen. Perhaps a more difficult question would be to get you to evaluate what might be the problem with the Spanish government doing this. And I think there you'd need to comment on the fact that at some point, whilst they're going to spend all this money and they probably will get another growth and another maturity, at some point they'll again get another decline. And all the people who are employed in tourism in Benidorm are going to suddenly become unemployed again. And that's going to cause you problems. What are you going to do next time to redevelop it? Are you going to keep going through this cycle over and over and over again? And every time I have to come up with something new to do there. I mean, what is there left? What else can we do there? If it goes into another bust and another stage four and five, what can we do next time in order to make this a better place? Or is this now the last time it can go through this tourist cycle? I think the final sort of question you might get here would be one which asks you to consider the perspective of local people on tourism. And it might ask you, why do you suppose tourists are unpopular with the people of Benidorm? And again, for a basic answer, you'd want to say things like, well, they've added pollution to the area, they're littering, they're causing problems with drunk and disorderly behaviour and that sort of thing. But for a more complex answer, you'd need to use the model of tourism, and you'd need to comment on the fact that it's seasonal. It provides employment, but only seasonal work, and so therefore they spend lots of the year without an awful lot of money. You'd perhaps also want to comment on the fact that local people would be upset that tourists can stop going there. It's a fickle industry, and they may stop going there. And if they do, that's going to cause mass unemployment and lots of people without jobs. Okay, so use both resource 5 and 6. You know, in resource 5, there's lots of information about the resort attracting lager louts and being, you know, offering poor quality hotels and that sort of thing. But use resource 6 and the fact that it's going to cause an economic decline in the area if the tourists stop coming. I think of all those three options, the first one is the most likely. You're going to get asked to analyze why has the Spanish government invested this money and what could be some of the problems of doing that. So let's move on to resource 7, which is all about ecotourism. It's difficult to know whether this resource 7 will be a standalone resource which you'll be asked questions on, or whether it's going to be treated as part of being in the same bracket as resource 8 and 9 and being part of your essay question. But we'll look at it individually, and then perhaps when we look at the essay question, we'll look to apply some of the ideas from it. So because of places like Benidorm and damage to the environment in tourist resorts, something called ecotourism has come about in the last 20 or so years. And it's the idea that you can be a tourist without damaging the environment. Well, how do you do that? And it gives us a guide here at the top. It says ecotourism is responsible travel to conserve natural areas that conserves the environment and improves the well-being of local people. So it's on paper, what a brilliant idea. We're going to go on holiday to a place. We're not going to damage the natural environment. In fact, we're going to conserve the natural environment, and we're going to improve the well-being of local people. We're going to improve their culture, and we're going to give them more money than they previously had. How does that happen? Well, it gives us 10 ways that will happen. So first of all, you've got to be prepared. You've got to know about the area you're visiting. So you have to do your research before you go there, and then you'll not want to damage it. You stay on paths, you keep to designated routes, you don't wander off and damage parts of the environment that are perhaps being preserved. You leave only footprints, so you take all your litter away with you. You don't leave anything behind other than your footprints. You take only pictures. You don't harm plants or wildlife. You support local enterprise by buying local products, obviously promoting the local economy. You do conservation, so you support local projects, and a lot of ecotourism holidays promote the idea of you going on holiday to help with local projects. So you help, I don't know, work in a game reserve in Africa or whatever it may be. You go local, so you stay in locally owned establishments. You don't go to the local Hilton. You stay in the local bed and breakfast or whatever it might be that's owned by the local people. You respect local traditions. You wear appropriate clothing, which means, if you're in a part of the world where it's impolite to wear very little clothing, then don't wear very little clothing. You know, cover up if that's the local tradition. It says wealth, you don't show off, so don't be going flashing the cash about and showing how much money you have. And have flexible expectations. Don't expect too much, don't expect five-star service, don't expect to be waited on, that kind of thing, because it won't happen on an eco-tourist holiday. Now, in theory, all this is great. Let's go to a place, let's enjoy it, let's not damage the environment. However, at the bottom it says, is it all good? It says people keep searching for unspoiled places off the beaten track, opening up previously undeveloped destinations, impacting on national parks and wildlife areas. So people are looking for places to do ecotourist holidays, and by doing so they're opening up new areas that previously were natural. So there's mega resorts, including luxury hotels, shopping centres and golf courses, are being established in nature reserves in the name of ecotourism. So people are setting up big holiday resorts, make an awful lot of money, and saying, oh, this is ecotourism, come and look at this. And actually, we can question whether it is that environmentally friendly. So most money from ecotourism is still being made by foreign-owned airlines, tour operators and developers who send the money back to their own more economically developed country. So we've got British or American or Japanese tourist companies who are going out there and building these environmentally friendly ecotourist places. And so the money being made there isn't going to local people. That money's going back to Britain or America or Japan and helping their economies rather than helping the local people. So indigenous populations are treated as entertainment. And is this really allowing them to keep their traditions and cultures alive? So there's a picture down the bottom right there of some sort of tribal people doing what looks like a dance or whatever. And people are going to watch this as a form of entertainment and not... Perhaps these people wouldn't do this anymore, but they're not being allowed to keep their traditions alive. They're doing it as a way of entertaining people, nothing else. It says local people are still left with low-paid service jobs such as tour guides, porters, and food and souvenir sellers. The work is often seasonal as they have no assurance of year-round employment. So they're working in the lesser-paid jobs. They're working as bar staff or waiting staff or cleaning staff, and they're perhaps only working for 6 months a year when the tourists are there. The big money jobs, the hotel owners and the restaurant owners, are still perhaps foreigners who are, or foreign international companies, MNCs, TNCs, which have set up business in the area. Now, it's unclear whether Resource 7 will have a question all of its own or whether it'll be attached to Resource 8 and 9 and be part of your essay question. If there is a question on it, we have to be prepared for that, and I believe the most likely thing is that you'd be asked perhaps something around about 5, 6, 7 marks, which asks you to do an analysis sort of for and against ecotourism, so offering some opinion on what's good about it and also offering some opinion on what in reality has turned out to be pretty bad about it. So you'd need to pick up on maybe 3 or 4 of the things that tell you how to be an ecotourism and explain them, expand on them. So you'd need to say perhaps with ecotourism, people stay on paths and they keep designated routes. But obviously you need to go further than that. As we've already said previously, you need to say by keeping on paths and keeping on designated routes, you don't damage certain areas. People can preserve certain areas and let them recover. People can rotate the parts of the region that you explore and allow other parts to recover. Okay, so you need to pick on some of these positives and expand on them and say why they're good for local people and why they're environmentally friendly, why they're economically friendly, why they're socially friendly, okay? You then need to go down to the bottom and pick on some of the negatives. Now, if you do get a question like this, I would draw your attention back to Resource 4, okay? Remember, Resource 4 tells us some of the problems associated with mass tourism and tells us some of the things that define responsible tourism. Okay, so when you're listing your sort of positives and negatives of ecotourism, use Resource 4. You know, pick up on some of the problems that might be caused by ecotourism and pick up on some of the things which make ecotourism responsible. Okay, so what is it that makes it environmentally friendly? What is it that makes it socially responsible? And what is it that helps the economy with ecotourism? Beyond a question which does a sort of for and against, it's difficult to imagine that they'd do too much else with Resource 7. I suspect, though, you'll need it when we come to the big question at the end, which is your essay question. Right, so at the end of all this, you've got to write an essay question, which is worth 16 marks out of 40, so almost half. And I recommend, and I certainly instruct my students, to spend roughly half the exam on this essay question. Certainly, if you realise you've only got 25 minutes left and you're still answering the short answer questions, I would stop at that point and immediately turn your attention to the essay question. But I would try and make sure you've got 30 minutes to attempt it. Now, this year's essay question is all about St. Lucia, which is an island in the Caribbean Sea. So it's one of the Caribbean islands. And you're going to be asked to look at tourism there, what's perhaps going wrong there, and what you think should be done to make it a bit more popular, make it a bit more money. So, as I said, it's in the Caribbean. So we know that the Caribbean, or most people will recognise the Caribbean as being a hot place, a tropical place, very, very popular with holidays. And if we look at Resource 8 first, it tells us an awful lot about St. Lucia. It tells us midway down eastern Caribbean island chain, one of the Windward Islands, east coast borders the Atlantic Ocean, west coast borders the Caribbean Sea. It's mountainous, it's a volcanic island. A few other things, got the capital, Castries, independence from the UK in 1979, an average GDP of £4,500, which is, and 48% of which comes from tourism. So the average person, roughly, in St. Lucia earns £4,600, which is very, very low. So it makes it an LEDC. And almost half of all the wealth in the country comes from tourism, so tourism is incredibly important. Other than tourism, the economy includes the production of bananas, light manufacturing, and offshore banking. It has a good infrastructure, good road and rail and telephone systems, and an educated workforce. Schools there are pretty good. Tourism, the main tourist season is January to April, and it's very popular with for beach resorts and for a stop for cruise ships. What are the attractions there? Well, we've got tropical beaches and coral reefs. We've got a rainforest. There's a volcano there, the world's only drive-in volcano crater. A number of activities that you can do there: diving, snorkeling, sailing, windsurfing, hiking, running trails, weddings and honeymoons are very popular there. Annually, you've got St. Lucia Jazz Festival, which attracts major performers. You've got the St. Lucia Food and Rum Festival, which is known worldwide, and you've got international cricket matches. And in fact, in 2010, it'll host the sorry, in 2010 it did host the World Cricket 2020 Championships, or was one of the host venues for that. Finally, at the bottom, it tells us about ecotourism in St. Lucia. It says increased competition from Latin America and fluctuating world prices for bananas have made the need for economic diversification in St. Lucia increasingly important. Tourism in St. Lucia is managed by the Ministry for Tourism. They're keen to strike a balance between economic development and protecting the unique physical landscape. Ecotourism has many advantages, but there are negatives too. These include being expensive and so attracting relatively small numbers of tourists. They are not suited to the very young or older tourists. The accommodation is often basic, and these holidays have limited appeal to sunbathers or sports enthusiasts. So, in the past, St. Lucia has looked at tourism as a way to make lots and lots of money. They want, if you look back quickly at Resource 6, they want to go through that growth in tourism model. They want to have a boom. They want tourism to go through a growth stage and a maturity stage. However, what they don't want is like what happened in Benidorm. They don't want a decline. They don't want people to suffer, and they don't want the environment to suffer, and they don't want to damage the place. So what they've done is they've put an emphasis so far on ecotourism. And they've tried to develop the island as an eco-tourist resort, and so we can see you look back again at Resource 7, you can see the sort of things they've tried to encourage. However, they found that it's been very expensive. They found that through eco-tourism, holidays to St. Lucia have become quite pricey, and that means that very few people can go and visit. They've also found that the type of holiday that eco-tourism offer is not appealing to older people or to children. And so that again rules out anyone with a family or anyone over a certain age. And finally, they've found that the accommodation is pretty basic, and the holidays only have limited appeal to sunbathers or sports enthusiasts. So anyone who's interested in sports or sunbathing is not really going to go for an eco holiday. So eco holiday, great, but is it really attracting the numbers of people that St. Lucia needs? Finally, if you turn over the page to Resource 9, this is the final thing. We've got a map of St. Lucia. And we've got some various different developments that are going on there. So it says tourist developments in St. Lucia. At the top, near Rodney Bay, we've got a large tourist complex, 284 luxury rooms, pools, restaurants, spas, water sports, and even an English pub. So this is your traditional large sort of five-star tourist complex, the sort of thing that you're going to pay a lot of money to go to. You're going to stay in the resort, you're going to go sit on the beach all day and probably have drink your cocktails in the evening, and you may never leave the resort, you may never see the rest of the island. In the middle of the island, we've got a small eco-tourist resort which is set in the rainforest, no TVs, radios, or air conditioning, close to Pitton's Heritage Site, which is a volcanically active part of St. Lucia. It's actually two volcanic plugs, which around which there are various sort of heated pools and mud spas and that sort of thing. And it's preserved, as we can see it here, it's a heritage site, so it's preserved, so they don't want too many tourists going there, they don't want it being damaged. So we've got this eco-tourist resort set in a beautiful location in the rainforest near to this site which needs to be preserved, which is all incredible natural beauty. At the bottom, we've got a smaller beach resort, which it says a resort with villas, suites, and guest rooms on a slope covered by forest next to a beautiful beach specialised in diving and other sports. So this is halfway between the two. Okay, it's not eco-tourism. We're not going to limit the sort of things that tourists can do, but it's small scale. It's not like the large tourist complex at the top. On the eastern side of the island, we've got an undeveloped coast. It's a series of unspoiled bays facing the Atlantic Ocean, well away from the main existing tourist area. So as yet, the eastern side of St. Lucia is more or less untouched. There's not really any kind of tourism there of any sort. So proceeding on to the final thing, what are you going to have to do? Well, you're going to need to write an essay on what St. Lucia should do in order to try and make more money from tourism. And in all likelihood, they'll ask you a question something along the lines of, so far, ecotourism in St. Lucia has failed to bring in the kind of money that St. Lucia wanted tourism to bring in. They wanted to be wealthier. They wanted tourism to make them rich. And ecotourism hasn't really worked. You need to come up with, almost certainly this will be the question, you'll need to come up with a plan for the tourist board of St. Lucia in order for them to make more money. And it'll probably involve developing the east coast of the island. And you'll need to analyse the various options that they give to you. And they'll probably give you 3, 4, maybe possibly 5 options of what to do. And the options will probably be develop a series of large tourist complexes on the east coast, develop some ecotourism, further develop ecotourism resorts along the east coast, develop a series of smaller beach resorts along the east coast, and leave the east coast undeveloped. Okay, and you'll need, for the top marks, you'll need to analyse each of those potential options, give positives and negatives of each one. And obviously this is a DME, a decision making exercise. You need to make a decision about which is the best option. Now, assuming that's the question, or the question is along those lines, I'm going to analyse sort of those few options in very basic terms. Now, you do need to be prepared that the question could be different. It may slightly differ from that. You need to be versatile. Whilst you need to understand the options I'm talking about, they may throw some different ones in on the day. They may set a slightly different question, and you need to be prepared for those subtle differences. So you do need to be light on your feet, and you do need to think about this. So let's go through the options. Now, option one is, let's develop St. Lucia with loads and loads of large tourist complexes. Let's encourage big international companies to come in, Hilton and whatever, and set up big 5-star hotels all around the island. Okay, you need to look at the positives and negatives of that. Well, the positives, let's look at our tourism. Go back, and I would talk about resource 6. I would say, if we do that, we're going to get a sudden growth in tourism in St. Lucia. We're going to go through stage 2 of the model, and we're going to reach stage 3 very quickly. It's going to suddenly encourage lots of people to come and visit the island, suddenly encourage lots of money. Local people are suddenly going to get much wealthier because we're getting loads more people coming in here. However, there are major disadvantages to that. Again, I would bring up the example of Benidorm. Are we going to get another Benidorm if we suddenly encourage loads and hotels to set up in St. Lucia? Are we going to damage the environment? Are we going to cause lots and lots of problems? Again, if we look back at resource 4, if we look at the problems associated with mass tourism, you can list any of those. You can say, right, if we start building lots and lots of big 5-star hotels all over St. Lucia and get loads of visitors, we're going to get increased urbanisation. We're going to get increased traffic. We're going to get destruction of habitats. Okay, so there's your positives and the negatives of that as a suggestion. More money, more wealth, quick development, but are we going to have environmental problems? Are we going to have some social problems? Are we going to have conflicts with locals? Option 2 is develop ecotourist resorts on the island. So continue this sort of program of ecotourism that we have that we've considered at the minute. And resource 7 is your guide here. Okay, so you can talk about some of the positives of that it promotes local businesses, that it preserves nature, that it respects local traditions. However, resource 7 also gives you some of the problems associated with ecotourism. So you could say that it's limited in terms of the people that it appeals to. It's not always as environmentally friendly as it seems. Locals still get left with low paid jobs. Okay, so if it asks you about whether we should develop ecotourism there, Resource 7 is absolutely your guide to this, and you can pull stuff out from there and explain why this is a good thing and why it can be a bad thing. Option 3 could be, let's develop some smaller beach resorts there. So it's not ecotourism, but it's small-scale resorts. It's not your 5-star Hiltons. It's sort of villas and small hotels being set up in the rainforest and on the beach. Now, obviously, your advantage here is that it doesn't damage the environment so much. So if we go back to Resource 4, when you talk about small beach resorts and whether they're a good idea, you can say that some of the problems associated with mass tourism won't occur. This isn't mass tourism. This is, you know, you're limiting the numbers of people who can do these sort of holidays. I would say that the advantages of your small scale tourism is all to do with this responsible tourism on resource four. Okay, I think that if you look at the three things that responsible tourism has to include, I think that small scale tourism does all those things. So it minimizes the negative impact, and it could positively contribute to the conservation of biodiversity. So by building small hotels and small sort of villas, you're not doing too much to damage the environment. And also, those people who are staying in those places are going to bring in money and wealth and probably allow people to conserve and preserve the environment slightly better. Then so socially, it respects culture and traditions and leads to a greater understanding between tourists and local people. It may be that by just having a few tourists come in, they're not going to cause too much conflict with local people, and they're more likely to get on with local people in comparison to major tourist resorts, which may cause conflict. Finally, it says economically has financial benefits for local people, as it's based on fair trade. Okay, it's more likely that small scale tourism is going to be fairer towards local people. However, obviously, it's not going to bring in the financial benefits that large scale tourism is. Okay. So we've got small-scale tourism, small villas and hotels. We've got advantages that it's going to be less destructive than large-scale tourism, but the disadvantage is that it's obviously not going to be as wealthy. It's also not going to be perhaps as environmentally friendly as ecotourism. Finally, we've got the fourth option, which is do nothing on the East Coast. And obviously, the advantage here is that this is costless, and it doesn't require the St. Lucia government to spend any money. It doesn't require you to build new hotels and facilities in an otherwise unspoiled area, and it preserves the natural beauty there. The major disadvantage is this will make them no money. St. Lucia has a problem with tourism. It wants to make more money from tourism, and if you don't develop the East Coast, you're never going to do that. So after you've given me a balanced account of what's good and bad about the options they give you, and like I say, the options that you may be given and the question you may be given may differ slightly, but the thought process still needs to be the same. You need to give an account of good and bad. But after you've done that, you need to make a decision. That's what's important here. You need to, based on your evidence and based on what you've gone through, you need to select an option, and you need to state it. So at the end of all your evidence, you say, right, based on all this, I suggest the St. Lucia government should do option whatever it is you may choose. Now remember, this is a sustainable decision-making exercise, okay? So whatever you choose needs to be the most sustainable option. It's not a case of I want to choose this option because it's going to bring in the most money, or I want to choose this option because it's the most environmentally friendly. It's about sustainability. So what does something have to do to be sustainable? Well, look back at resource four. Look back at responsible tourism and minimizing the effects model. In order for something to be sustainable, it's got to be environmentally friendly, socially friendly, and economically friendly. Okay, it's got to do all the things that the model at the bottom of resource four says. So what you need to do is select an option which fulfills the most of those. Which option is the most environmentally friendly whilst also preserving society, whilst also making money? Now, no option is going to be perfect. It's very unlikely that you're going to get one option which it fulfills everything on resource four. But you need to select the one which does it best. So at the end of your essay, you need to say, having analysed each of the options, I would suggest the St. Lucia government option one, because I feel that it will bring in economic benefit and it will protect society. I'm prepared to accept that it will produce some sort of environmental damage. So it is the most sustainable of all the options. Okay, thank you for downloading this podcast. Hopefully it was helpful to at least some people. Like I say, it's not this style of revision or this style of learning is very much not for everybody. Some people much prefer to do things in their own way. But if you've got this far, hopefully you found it at least slightly useful. Good luck to everyone with your exam, and good luck with the rest of your OCRB studies for the rest of the year.